Good morning, everyone. It's not simply because the Washington Redskins actually might have a chance to make it to the playoffs that all of Washington is talking about laterals and handoffs in these weeks of the transition. Virtually everything that President Bush refers to, whether it's the economic meltdown or the auto industry bailout, is an issue that is being teed up, lateraled, or handed off to the new administration. The Obama administration will have to deal with all of it. And on tap this morning is, of course, the reference that the president made at the top of our program, talking about an orderly bankruptcy for the auto industry. It's part of the inheritance for the Obama administration, as this administration, outgoing, currently tries to figure out what it's going to do for or about the big three. And joining us to talk about the inheritance, quite literally, is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He's author of the upcoming book, The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. He joins us from Washington. David, thanks for being part of the program.
Yeah, good to be back with you, John.
So tell us about this orderly bankruptcy option that you've reported on that seems to be surfacing in Washington that is something of a I can't tell if it's a favor they're doing the big three or if it's a sense of punishment and signs of bad times to come vis-a-vis Washington.
John, you ever haggled for a car?
Yeah, unsuccessfully, always.
Well, that's what you're watching going on right here. Look, it may turn out in the end that GM and perhaps Chrysler have to go into bankruptcy court. But by talking about bankruptcy here, I suspect what the administration is doing is trying to avoid that option, because George Bush doesn't want to leave office in the last 30 days of an administration that has had some other challenges, let's say, to the news that the world's biggest car maker and once the icon of American manufacturing is sitting in Chapter 11. What they want to do, if they can, is essentially what that House legislation that died in the Senate last week would have done, which was set up a managed restructuring, a forced negotiation that is done outside of bankruptcy court, in which the unions, the creditors, and the car makers all give in something and presumably come up with some kind of way to make the car makers viable. But the only way to get them there, especially in the absence of the legislation, is to start talking publicly about, gee, it'd be terrible if this didn't work out and we had to go leave it to the hands of a bankruptcy judge.
Right. So it's a bit of a, you know, big stick approach here. But, you know, in the way that these negotiations have gone on and the kinds of sound bites that we've heard over the last couple of weeks, it seems to me that, OK, we're going to bail out the big three. But then they go into a room somewhere, they open some book, they see something, and all of a sudden everything stops for a while. It's almost like there's something they're not telling us. Is it really as complicated as all of that?
Well, it's made more complicated by the fact that Congress didn't act last week. Because, remember, you've had an administration that for months has been saying that this TARP legislation, the troubled assets legislation that authorized the bailouts of the banks, was not intended for industrial companies and would not be used for industrial companies. Then Congress couldn't come together on a way to go deal with the auto companies, and President Bush is facing the prospect of the bankruptcy that we're discussing and, of course, the unemployment that would add to the 533,000 lost jobs last month. And suddenly, what do you know, they're trying to figure out a way to make sure that TARP legislation actually could be used for an industrial company.
All right, but for the furloughed auto workers who are going to have a lot of time to focus on the details here, what should they take from all this?
Well, there are a couple things that are going to happen, and, you know, I wrote a piece earlier this week that likened this to the Mideast negotiations. And I liken it to the Mideast negotiations because it's one of those cases where for 30 years we have all known, or at least for 10 years, we've all known what the rough outlines of an agreement look like, but we can't figure out how to get all the negotiators there. So one element of this is it's likely that the unions, as they now themselves recognize, are going to have to agree to total compensation cuts that would bring their income down to about the levels of the workers who work at Japanese or German auto plants in the United States. Those are the non-unionized plants. The second thing that's going to happen is that the creditors to these car companies are going to have to take a huge haircut. probably, you know, they would be lucky to get 30 cents on the dollar. If you look at how their bonds are being traded right now, people are guessing they would get more like 15 cents on the dollar. So 30 cents may look pretty good to them. And the auto companies themselves are going to have to both downsize, take compensation cuts for the chief, for the top executives, obviously, and close a lot of factories.
David, this is what I don't understand. Why can't the Treasury write the check and then impose the same kind of constraints that the bankruptcy courts would on the company, on the companies, on the labor unions, and so on? If you want the money, then you must comply with these list of things, some of which you just mentioned.
Well, some of them they could, and they could say, look, if you want the money, here's what you got to go do. But that means getting many different participants to agree, the creditors, the unions, and the companies. Whereas when you were dealing with the banks, they basically could call in the bank chief executives and say, either sign this document and walk out the door, dealing with, you know, one person, or they could say, you know, don't sign this document and see how long you'll last in the market.
Right, but they know what the alternatives are, because Detroit, the folks from the auto industry, are the ones arguing that if we go down, here are all the terrible ripple effects.
That's right. But you don't have just one player here.
Right.
What you've got is the multiple players. And the unions in particular are thinking, gee, if we can hold on for 30 days, and so far we've held on for 30 years in this process, we might get a better deal out of Obama.
All right. But, you know, complexity hasn't kept the United States away from the Middle East, per se, although the Bush administration doesn't have much of a legacy there. Is it really the case that it's too complex, or the government just doesn't want to get involved because they don't want to get hung with the failure?
Well, they don't want to get hung with losing the taxpayers' money.
I see.
And so let's say, for example, that the taxpayers were on the hook for $14 billion here, which was the number that was kicking around in the House bill last week. Obviously, the debt to the U.S. taxpayers comes first. But if they can't come up with some kind of long-term viability plan, they'll burn through that money in 5, 6, 7 months, and we'll be right back where we are today. So they want to make sure, or so President Bush said yesterday, that I think President Bush's phrase was that we're not throwing good money after bad.
Well, you know,
you don't want a bridge loan to nowhere.
Right. Well, on that precise point, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about the title of your book, The Inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
It's looking a little bit more like a sinkhole, what Obama is going to get from the world right now as he takes power on January 20th. As a legacy for the Bush administration, I mean, it's not so much that Obama is inheriting things, is that he's being hung with stuff that are going to be very, very difficult challenges certainly in the first quarter of 2009.
Hey, you know, not every inheritance is always pleasant, right?
Right.
People think inheritance, and they think, "Gee, big pot of money at the end of the rainbow here." Not this time. The book tries to lay out, mostly in the foreign policy sphere, what were the true costs of the distraction of the Iraq War. The argument of the book is that beyond the awful cleared costs of Iraq, you know, more than 4,000 Americans dead, untold numbers of Iraqis dead, $800 billion. It seems like everything Washington does these days is $700 or $800 billion, right? It's the bottom line number. But the real cost was the cost that we were, the opportunity cost, that we found ourselves in a situation where Iran is on the verge of a nuclear weapon, because you had a president who couldn't stand up after Iraq and talk publicly about countries getting weapons of mass destruction. North Korea's got 8 at the end of the Bush administration, up from 0 or 1 when he came in. As you go around the world, Afghanistan is in far worse shape, in part because we moved too many troops over to Iraq and thought the Taliban were gone. And Pakistan is fighting both sides of the war.
Right.
So what the book tries to do is pace you through how we got where we are and what Obama's options are.
Well, let's very quickly, because we're under a minute here, would you look for Obama creating some sort of new relationship in a part of the world that we haven't focused on typically as a way out of this? Or would you figure that he would recreate a broad coalition starting in Europe, as most presidents do?
I think he'll start in Europe because it's the easiest win. He's got a bigger challenge in Asia than he thinks, because China, during the time that that President Bush has been in power, has truly managed to expand its own power because we were distracted elsewhere.
All right. Well, it's great stuff. The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and the Challenges to American Power. David Sanger is the author and the chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.